This is All About Living with Carol Colby. All About Living is brought to you by Gunderson Funeral Home Cremation Care, Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, Prevagen, Home Health United, The Medicine Shop Monona, Independent Living, All About Living with Carol Colby.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome again to All About Living. I'm Carol Colby. Always a pleasure to have you with us. This segment of our program is brought to you today by Gunderson Funeral and Cremation Care, the Life Celebration Center, and Turville Bay MRI and Radiation Oncology Center in Madison, where expertise with compassion is powerful medicine. Well, I don't know how many of you love American history. I do. And I think thanks to my experience many years ago when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and I took a course in American history. And I'll never forget the one lecture that I attended. This was a lecture on Abraham Lincoln. And of course, it was one in one of the big halls. And there were hundreds of students in the room. And the professor walked out onto the stage, walked up to the podium, the microphone, and looked out at all of us, and then said, 9 months after Abraham Lincoln married Mary Todd, they had a son. And that was the biggest aha moment for me because I thought Abraham Lincoln was a real person. And then I began to look at American history as a series of real people. People who have different backgrounds, different philosophies, different values, different experiences, and putting all of this together, their capabilities, and they created what was our past. And our present today is creating the past for the next generation. And so American history to me became a series of understanding people. Now, I don't know if that's a woman's thing or not, but it certainly has been my perspective on American history. And I have loved it ever since, and particularly studying the people. And that's why reading the biographies of anybody in our American history, both the men and the women who have been leaders, has been particularly exciting to me. Well, much could be said about Woodrow Wilson, our 28th president of the United States, because in reading about him, I'm not sure it was 9 months after, but I bet it was 10 months after he and Ellen Axon were married. They had their first daughter. And so there are some comparisons between. I don't know if there are other comparisons as well, but we'll ask our guest here on All About Living today. I have in front of me the book, Woodrow Wilson, A Biography by John Milton Cooper, Jr. And sitting across from me is John Milton Cooper, Jr. He is the author of this very thorough, detailed book, not only on the history of our nation during the Wilson era, but on the man and his family. And this is what is particularly appealing about this book for me. John Milton Cooper is actually one of our own. He is a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin. He is the author also of Breaking the Heart of the World, Wilson and the Fight for the League of Nations, and The Warrior and the Priest, Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, among other books that he has written. He was recently a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., but he lives here in Madison, Wisconsin, because he is a professor here. And one of the things, there are many, many things said about Professor Cooper, and if I can find my notes here, the Woodrow Wilson Presidential Library describes you, Professor Cooper, as the foremost Woodrow Wilson scholar in the country. So I feel honored and privileged to have you here in the studio with me today, and thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure to be here, Carol.
Well, first of all, let's talk about you a little bit. Why did you write this book at this time? There has been a lot written about Woodrow Wilson, but why right now?
Well, because a bunch of people asked me to. And it seemed like the right thing to do. As you mentioned, some of those books, I didn't start out to, way back when I got into academia, I didn't start out particularly to work on Woodrow Wilson. I became attracted to the era around World War I. And if you get into that era, this sort of the first two and a half decades of the 20th century, it's pretty hard not to be attracted to Woodrow Wilson and to Theodore Roosevelt. I liken us scholars to a bunch of moths, and these are the two brightest flames that it's pretty hard not to be attracted to, although another very bright flame that a lot of us are attracted to and interested in is Robert La Follette, because this was the great flourishing of his career, too, and this is also when Wisconsin was known as the flagship state for progressivism, the laboratory of democracy. So it's quite an exciting time.
How long did it take you to write this? This is filled with details.
I started right about the beginning of 2000, to write it. I started and write it, and then, of course, when you go to write something, you begin to learn what you don't know. In other words, where the gaps are. Since I'd done a lot of work in the period before, I did have quite a bit of research behind me. But I started in 2002, and it took me the better part of 6 years, 6 to 7 years, to write it there.
And you did spend a few months at you were a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars?
That's a federally sponsored, they call it a living memorial to Wilson. What they try to do is bring scholars and people who make policy or are interested in policy together, because that's what he wanted to do. He was never an ivory tower academic. He always believed that what he did and what scholars did should have an impact on the world, and especially since he was a political scientist, on public affairs, government, politics.
This era, Teddy Roosevelt, or T.R.
T.R.,
T.R. Roosevelt.
He hated that nickname. He said he did anyway.
And Woodrow Wilson, this is kind of your area of specialty.
It has been.
I've been learning about history professors that they have specialties just like the medical field has.
That's right. I'm afraid so. And we get more and more specialized, which means the stuff that we haven't been working on recently, we do get a little outdated on. We have to catch up there.
How did you develop your own love for history to the point of becoming this eminent national scholar and scholar on Wilson and Roosevelt?
Carol, when I started out, I was interested in politics and I was interested in literature. And I thought, well, maybe sometime I might be a politician or I might be a novelist. And being a historian kind of splits the difference. You know, I'm able to do both. And I also thought maybe that was somewhat like Wilson. Maybe that was more where my talents lay, where I would be happier.
So, well, it did mimic his background a little bit.
Well, yes, although I don't want to make it too similar. I like to say there's a historiographical fallacy. I came from a Southern Presbyterian background, actually went to a high school in Washington, D.C. that was named after him, and then I did go to his alma mater to college, to Princeton. So, you know, there were those things. I even started out, my first teaching job was at a women's college, the way his was. So you could, but that, I don't push that too far. I mean, I didn't try to make myself a reincarnation. And my early interest was more in the period and the times, especially in World War I, rather than in the man per se. I mean, mm-hmm. That's something that grew over time as I got more and more into the field.
Okay, and one more question about you before we get into Woodrow Wilson. How did you end up here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison?
I got offered a job.
Okay.
And for me, I had been teaching at Wellesley College, which is Mrs. Clinton's alma mater, and a very, very fine school. I liked it a lot. But to be asked to come here to teach American history at the UW was like having somebody who'd been playing with a very, very good minor league ball club being given a tryout for the Yankees. I mean, that is the reputation and the tradition that the UW History Department has, especially in U.S. history. So for me, there was a no-brainer choice. Of course I came here.
And you've been here how many years now?
40.
Whoa. Well, and we are better off for it.
Well,
certainly,
thank you.
You have certainly brought a lot to the plate here at the university, and to people who are scholars or just interested in American history, you have helped us all gain a better understanding, particularly of this World War I period of time. What did you learn about Woodrow Wilson that you didn't know before writing this book?
That's a good question. I got more into the way his mind and his character worked. I was really struck with what an independent thinker he was from a very early age. This is a man who, he wasn't a rebel against his background, but you could see more that this was a man who was simply rising above it. He came out, he was born in the South on the eve of the Civil War. In fact, he said his first conscious memory when he was a boy of not quite four was hearing the news that Mr. Lincoln had been elected and that would mean war. In other words, the South would secede and there would be war. Grew up during the Civil War. His father had a church in Augusta, Georgia, which was used as a hospital for wounded Confederate soldiers. They also would house captured Union soldiers on their way to Andersonville prison there. So he grew up among that, yet very soon he began to look at things from a national perspective. He was, I don't think he was ever that much of a Southerner. He's our only Southerner who was elected president before Lyndon Johnson, between the Civil War and Lyndon Johnson. And that had some significance for his politics and his administration. But in shaping him, I became less and less impressed with that background, that this was a man who really began to think for himself at a very early age. And, what an interesting mind he has. It's kind of nice to have presidents who are reflective, deeply thoughtful people, and he certainly was one of them.
Well, he did, from what I got from reading the book and what you're talking about, to me, even though he was born and raised in the South and lived in several areas in the South, his community was his family.
Yes, it was. His family and his church. Religion played a great role in his life, although I think it's something that often gets distorted by others. He was the son, grandson, nephew, and later son-in-law of Presbyterian ministers. He was born in a manse. He grew up. Really, that was his world, and then his family as well. The family is interesting, too, because his mother was born in England, and his entire background was either Scottish or Scotch-Irish. He had no American-born grandparents, which actually makes him the first president since Andrew Jackson for whom that's the case. And Barack Obama is the only other president to have a foreign-born parent since Andrew Jackson. So Wilson is it's interesting in that way. And they had come to, the two halves of the family had come to independently to Ohio. And then some of them, Wilson's father and one of his uncles both moved to the South. They became ardent Confederates. They took on the loyalty of where they were. But it was a very close very interesting family, and as from what I could see, a very warm and supportive family too.
They loved their Tommy. Oh, it was Thomas Woodrow
that's
Wilson.
Right, Tommy.
He was Tommy up until his 20s when actually took the name Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, and
that was
actually fairly common for people in those days to kind of settle on a name. Like Grover Cleveland was Stephen Grover Cleveland, and he became Grover Cleveland at some point.
Mm-hmm.
What's got the right ring for your profession? Or as in Wilson's case, as a writer, he thought Woodrow Wilson had a nicer alliterated
ring.
Well,
with a name like Woodrow Wilson, you've got to be president. We're going to stop for a break, and I want to come back and talk a little bit more about his family and then how that precipitated moving into his education, becoming a professor, then president of Princeton, then governor of New Jersey, and then president of the United States, all in a relatively short period of time. I mean, he was on a straight track up, but there were some personal tales along the way that really bring the man and the person out. We're talking about the book Woodrow Wilson, a biography by John Milton Cooper Jr., who is a professor, a history professor here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we will return to our conversation about Woodrow Wilson with the author himself after these messages from our sponsors. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY.
This is All About Living with Carol Colby, Madison 1670 WTDY.
Welcome back to our program. This segment is brought to you by Home Health United. You got a friend right here online at homehealthunited.org. And the medicine shop, Monona, caring beyond prescriptions. I'm Carol Colby, and with me today is John Milton Cooper Jr., and he is the author of the book Woodrow Wilson, a biography. And this is a story of not only the details of history around the World of War I period that Wilson was president, during the time Wilson was president, but this is the story of the man and the people who surrounded him. And for that reason, it really, really comes to life because we learned to know Woodrow Wilson as well as some of the historical events of that time. And we were talking before the break, Professor Cooper, about Woodrow Wilson and his family and his independent thinking and his really eagerness to learn. But I think his upbringing is perhaps as representative of any of the importance of parental involvement and guidance. His parents loved him and they nurtured him and they really held his hand not to formulate who he was, but to nurture his educational spirit. And his mother, whom he adored, he described as she really developed his love of the best womanhood. And he so loved her and so respected and admired her that that followed through in all of his relations with women from that point on. And then his father, although one of their servants described Wilson, he said, outside Mr. Tommy was his father's boy, but inside he was his mother all over. But his father, after Woodrow Wilson became 8 or 9 years old, he spent more time with him, and everyone recognized his father's influence. And this one section from your book really talks about how his father taught him to learn. He spent a lot of time in his father's company. He was good fun, Wilson recalled in his 50s. He was a good comrade, and by constant association with him, I saw the world and the tasks of the world through his eyes. Even after Tommy started school, he spent Mondays, which was a minister's day off, with his father, who took him to see sights he thought might interest or educate a boy. Afterward, his father would have Tommy write an essay about what he had seen. After his son had read the essay aloud, Dr. Wilson would say, "Now put down your paper and tell me in your own words what you saw." Tommy would then give a shorter, more direct account, and his father would respond, "Now write it down that way." Now, can you imagine the depth, the layers of learning through that process of having to develop your ownership of what you saw versus just seeing something?
His father was, Joseph Wilson was not, unusually for a Presbyterian perhaps, he was not all that interested in theology. He was a much more outgoing, worldly sort of Presbyterian minister. And what he really cared about was rhetoric, was speaking, how somebody spoke. And that was Tommy, his son Tommy, was his prize pupil. Wilson in turn said his father was the best teacher he ever had. Now, you know, that sounds a little bit like love for, you know, filial piety there, but not really. I mean, he really meant it, and I think mm-hmm. as you said there, Carol, it really comes through the love and the attention there. One reason that his father came into his life more after he was 8 was that during the Civil War, his father had been away a lot. He was a chaplain with the Confederate forces, and then he was very active in the hospitals and the various care facilities for wounded soldiers. He was very active in that, so he was away a lot. But once he got back, then he is a big presence in his son's life again. Oh, yeah.
Well, learning was difficult for Woodrow Wilson, for Tommy at the time, because he had difficulty reading.
We can't know this for a fact, but he may have had a mild form of dyslexia. A lot of scholars have speculated back and forth about that. He certainly was slow to learn to read. He was never a natural speed reader. His great rival Theodore Roosevelt was. You know, there's an interesting mm-hmm. contrast there. Both deeply learned men, both intellectuals, but contrast in that way. But it was difficult for him. And it's interesting to see the compensations that he went in for. He taught himself shorthand when he was a teenager, so that he could take notes, and that was a way of, he'd have these shorthand symbols that he could see and immediately grasp something. He also took up the typewriter when it was a brand new invention. I mean, that's a little bit like somebody taking up computers back in the 1960s. You can see him grabbing on to different things to make this task easier for him. And to me, there's something heroic about somebody for whom reading comes with such difficulty becoming a scholar, you know, mm-hmm. versus becoming a writer and a scholar, where that's what it's all about.
But he loved reading.
Oh, yes.
He loved his books. But then he loved oratory.
Yes, yes. Well, for him, speaking and writing were two parts of the same thing. He moved back and forth very easily from those. But what he would do, when he would speak, he would much prefer to speak without a prepared text. He really didn't like that very much. He later, as president, he had to for formal occasions. But what he liked to do was either jot down a few shorthand notes, a brief shorthand outline, sometimes on the back of a calling card, or speak with no notes at all. And when he gets into public life, we have the notes, which have been transcribed by the editors of the Wilson Papers. So you can see the notes. And then when he gets into public life, there'd be stenographers who would take down the final speech. And you can see the notes and then the speech. And it's breathtaking how sparse and sketchy the notes are and how finished and polished the final thing is. There are no ums and ahs. The sentences are beautifully constructed. They're perfect. There's nothing, no dangling participles, no ending of sentences, a bad word, a preposition is a bad word to end a preposition with. None of that stuff. I mean, it's really remarkable. I can't do that. I don't. There are some people who can, but I need lots of notes, and I still fumble around. So most of us just can't do that. But I think a lot of that comes back to this need he felt to compensate for the difficulty. One other thing he said when he was writing. He would have the whole paragraphs together in his mind before he put them down on the paper. Mm-hmm. And he very seldom rewrote. We can see manuscripts of things that he did. And he would go back, but not a lot of rewriting, much less rewriting than most of the rest of us do.
I think he had it written in his mind.
That's right. That's
and
right.
He must have had some tool that he used mentally to memorize that, and it was imprinted there visually in his mind.
That's right.
But then that typewriter, even to the almost the end of his presidency, he typed on that typewriter.
Oh, yeah.
He typed his own speeches.
That's
he
right.
wrote his own speeches.
Right.
He didn't have this bevy of speechwriters that surrounded him.
It never occurred to him not to write his own speeches. I mean, that's what he'd been doing for all of his adult life, back into his high school and college days. He'd been doing his own speeches. It simply didn't occur to him not to do that. The only time when he had to depart from that was after he'd had his stroke. And he did allow his secretary, Joe Tumulty, to write his messages to Congress and some things. But that pained him deeply to have to do that, to have to rely on somebody else. And Tumulty, by that time, had been with him for a long time and
right.
really could mimic his boss very well and could get the rhythm and get the phrases.
It was interesting, the few people that surrounded him over a long period of time, Tumulty and Colonel House?
Yes, Colonel House. That's an interesting character.
Yes.
Very, very interesting relationship.
We're leaping ahead now to the presidency, but there were these few key people.
Yeah. Wilson was somebody, he was not a naturally gregarious man. Now, this didn't mean that he couldn't get along well with people and enjoy being with people, but he was not somebody who, when he had a choice of how to spend his time, A lot of times he wanted to be by himself. And when he made big decisions, he would seek lots of advice, he would listen to it, but at a certain point he would turn it off and he would seclude himself. So it was not the matter of the last person or thrashing it out with somebody again and again. And unlike Bill Clinton, who was rewriting the State of the Union speech on the way in the limousine on the way to the Capitol. Now, Wilson went by himself, decided it, and then if he had a statement or a speech to write about it, he would do it again by himself. So he preferred having a few people around him rather than lots and lots of advisors and cycling people through there. He liked to rely on a few people. One was Louis Brandeis, whom he met during the 1912 campaign and became, particularly on domestic economic affairs, Brandeis became his most important advisor. And, of course, he appointed Brandeis to the Supreme Court, which was one of the great decisions that he made. But then Joe Tumulty. Tumulty had actually been sort of a political opponent when he started out in New Jersey, but very quickly became converted to him and became his loyal secretary through his governorship and his presidency. Secretary, by the way, really was chief of staff, except there wasn't much of a staff. Tumulty mm-hmm. was the one who ran that side of the White House. Colonel House is, he felt he was his intimate advisor. It's hard to tell, though, and there was an emotional bond between the two of them, but it's hard to tell how Wilson himself really regarded House. The reason for that is House kept a diary, which is a very important, interesting diary that we all use. It's an indispensable source. But the problem is it's all through House's point of view. Very rarely. There's one interesting letter he wrote to Edith Galt when he was courting her about House, but you very rarely see what Wilson thinks of House. You don't get that relationship through Wilson's eyes. You get it through House's eyes. And House, well, like any diary keeper, any autobiographer, magnified himself. And also, House wanted to manipulate Wilson and believed he could. And I think he deluded himself in some cases that as to how much influence he had. But they were close, but then there was a break. Eventually, House began to rub Wilson the wrong way, and the differences in policy. That was, this isn't, you're getting way ahead now. You're getting at the end of the war and the peacemaking. But
well,
that,
and his health was failing, too, and with that, some of the decision-making that he was known for started to change and become a little bit more obsessional.
What happens before the stroke is still, that's a matter for speculation and argument. I used to think that you could locate some of this before the stroke, some of these differences. I'm not so sure of that now. And by the way, I've been advised some very, very good neurologists here at the UW that I consulted on the earlier book especially, told me, don't be so sure. I said that many people that they see who suffer strokes like Wilson's actually operate full capacity or nearly full capacity right up to the time of the stroke, so that it's, you got to be very, very careful and very, very circumspect about trying to relate anything before that. Now, after the stroke, I mean, that's wow. I mean, you really can see the difference there.
Well, perhaps just his schedule prior to the stroke. Oh. He just drove himself.
Well,
he was tireless, but he was, you know,
well,
fatigued from being tireless in his efforts.
Well, his schedule, it's interesting that up until the end of World War I, Wilson was able to control his time very well. He actually set what many people would think was a rather leisurely pace as president. He would devote himself, he would give it utter concentration when he was in the office and on the job, and then he got away from it.
And he played golf. He loved golf.
He played golf. They would sing and do limericks, and he would do imitations.
Yeah.
He wanted to leave the job behind him, and that led to some family problems because his youngest daughter married his Secretary of the Treasury, William Gibbs McAdoo, who was a dynamic man, a real force in politics. And McAdoo was one of these driving people who's essentially on the job all the time. So when they would come to family dinners, Mac would want to talk business. And Wilson's brother-in-law, who was one of the people who knew him best, said, there was a certain way that Wilson would politely try to put it aside and then grow silent. And then he said you would get that stony stare from Woodrow Wilson. And McAdoo never quite seemed to get it.
No,
there.
And he didn't want to be left alone in the room with his son-in-law because he didn't want to talk about business.
That's right, yes.
He liked when he was separate from his work. He really had a good time. We need to stop for another break. When we come back, I want to talk about the women in his life. That was most interesting. We're talking on All About Living today here in Madison 1670. WTDY, to John Milton Cooper Jr., who is the author of Woodrow Wilson, a Biography. For a podcast of this program, go to carolcobyradio.com. That's Carol Coby, K-O-B-Y, radio.com. And we'll be right back to continue our conversation after these messages from our sponsors.
This is All About Living with Carol Colby, Madison 1670, WTDY.
We're back with John Milton Cooper Jr., who is the author of the biography Woodrow Wilson. And this segment of our program is brought to you by Independent Living, your connection to an independent life. We've been talking about Woodrow Wilson, the man, and you bring him to life so magnificently in your book, Professor Cooper. But part of his life was the women in his life, and I don't want to have this conversation go by without talking about that. What intrigued me, and I know has intrigued other women, and I don't know, again, if this is a gender thing and if women seem more interested in this than men who read your book, and I don't know that you've even researched that, but Woodrow Wilson was quite an amorous man.
Oh, yes.
He loved women. He fell in love with his first cousin and was turned down by her and was crushed for a period of time. and he loved her dearly and expressed it very amorously. Then he fell in love with Ellen Axon, who was well suited for him with her background coming from her father was a minister, and she was a scholar and an intellect herself and an independent thinker. And so the women that he did surround himself with were strong women, and they were bright women, and probably a reflection of his mother.
That could be, Carol. I think Wilson's unusual for his time, and maybe for later times as well among American men, more men more generally, that he really respected women for mm-hmm. their minds, as well as he was also, frankly,
well, he did for his their bodies too.
Oh yes,
my goodness.
No, this was a warm to hot man. There's no question about it.
He liked
to share his thoughts and open his mind to them. Once he and Ellen became engaged, in other words, once they declared their love for each other, the correspondence they had. Later, it's after they're married, it's correspondence when they're apart. But there was a 2-year engagement while he was going to graduate school, and she had family affairs that she had to tend to, particularly involving the death of her father. The correspondence that flows between them is really absolutely remarkable, and I think the only equivalent we have among a president and his spouse is John and Abigail Adams. I mean, mm-hmm. just the. And it's not one-sided. It's not Wilson simply sounding off and posing and posturing and having an adoring audience there. Ellen writes back to him, and the shrewdest advice I think he ever got from anybody about particularly his career and about public affairs came from Ellen. Nobody else gave him such shrewd advice. Then there are two other people. The correspondence with Edith, his second wife, is not so extensive because they were together even before they're married. They're together in Washington more, although there's a lot of good correspondence there. And then they were really seldom, if ever, apart after they were married. The other person, though, is Mrs. Peck. And this is the
yes.
whole question about did he or did he not have an affair. But the correspondence he conducts with her, again, is marvelous. Unfortunately, there, we only have his side. I believe she destroyed her letters to him, or somebody, maybe either Ellen or Edith, destroyed her letters to him. But we do have his letters to her, which are marvelous again. I mean, they're very, very revealing. He liked to open his mind there.
Yeah, he poured out his heart and his mind to
That's
these
right.
women. But this Mary Peck came along, and it did create some kind of a distance between him and Ellen.
For
and
a
Ellen
while.
Was very aware of this.
Yeah, she was. It came at a moment of vulnerability, as these things often do. Wilson had just turned 50. Just before his 50th birthday, he had a health incident, which was he had a hemorrhage in one of his eyes, which didn't leave him blind in that eye, but diminished the sight. And it was clear that there was an underlying cardiovascular condition, that the arteriosclerosis was there. And the physicians understood that then. And the worry was that this would mean the end of his career, at the height of his powers. Well, he snapped back from that. But this was kind of a wake-up call, and the mortality, reminder of mortality. And he was going through some real troubles at Princeton at the same time, including one where his best friend broke with him over and in a very, very rather nasty public way over these. And at this point, Wilson was going off. He had been ordered more or less by his doctors to take more vacation. So he went off twice to Bermuda by himself, just a break, about a 3-week break in February. And that's where he met Mrs. Peck. So I think you can see the vulnerability there. Then he saw her on Bermuda. Then she came back to the United States. He saw her some more. The question is that we don't know and never will know is how far did it go? Wilson was, we can tell from his earlier relations with Ellen and later with Edith, that this was a sexually ardent man.
Yes.
And did it?
And he expressed it openly to his wives.
Oh, yes. Yes, he did. He sure did. And this, the only two people who knew were Wilson and Mary Peck, and neither of them ever said. This became an issue, though. I mean, there was some smoke that came up from this, and several times there were threats that maybe this would be revealed. And during the 1912 campaign, this came up, and he was running against Theodore Roosevelt. And some people asked Roosevelt, should we use these? Roosevelt said, people can't imagine somebody who looks like the apothecary's clerk being Romeo. Well, T.R. was wrong. Wilson did have a certain long-jawed look. He might look like the drugstore, the local druggist to some people, but he certainly was a Romeo.
No, and he did have a way with women.
Yeah.
Interesting that Mrs. Peck went on to get a divorce. Twice divorced. But then when his first wife died after a year in the White House, he didn't pursue Mrs. Peck.
No.
And he then met Edith.
He met Edith. That became not exactly a scandal, but people worried. The convention in those days was that widows and widowers should not remarry at all. You know, that was the ideal. Well, people being people fell short of the ideal. But then the next best thing, and perfectly acceptable, was that they would remarry after, and the phrase was, remember, a decent interval of time. Well, how long was that? Well, that might vary. Wilson remarried about 15 months after his first wife's death. That was regarded as pushing it, very much pushing it. And a lot of his political advisors worried, you know, when he said he wanted to marry again, that this would harm him and so forth and politically. Well, turned out it didn't. In fact, Edith was a very attractive woman, and it was clear how happy the president was with her, and the first public appearance together was, appropriately enough, at a baseball game, because Wilson had played baseball a lot as a young man and was a lifelong ardent baseball fan. And there's there's a wonderful picture of the two of them at a baseball game, you know, just beaming at each other. And no, that was great publicity.
People love a love story.
That's right.
And she was, from all descriptions, just a beautiful woman, very gracious, very outgoing. I suspect, just from reading about her in your book, I felt that she enjoyed being First Lady more than Ellen did.
Very, very much so. And Edith even admits in her autobiography that part of the attraction, of her attraction to Wilson, was that he was president. She's honest about that. And I think she got something other than what she bargained for. I mean, clearly she wanted to be the first hostess of the land. She was a very stylish woman and loved clothes and really wanted to show off this way. Unfortunately, she didn't get much of a chance to do it. Really, just for about the first year, and not even the first year of their marriage, because very quickly, they had to go into the election campaign, so don't get to do so much entertaining there. And then once the election was over, there's a little bit again of a season, but immediately you get the submarine crisis and into the war. And the war, during the war, of course, it was just not done. You know, it's a wartime austerity and set an example. And she did. She did volunteer work. Canteens for the soldiers.
But he counseled with her the same way he did.
Oh, absolutely.
In the letters he wrote to Mrs. Peck and with his first wife, Ellen.
He made her his principal advisor. And that's when Colonel House begins to fade out of the picture.
She didn't really care for Colonel House.
She never liked him. She didn't try to come between Wilson and him because she saw how much Wilson relied on him in certain ways. But the intimacy with House was just not quite the same. And eventually, when Wilson himself began to get irritated with House, Edith was glad to abet that then. But when, you know, after he had his stroke, there was a lot of question as to how much power Edith had, what she actually did.
And was accused of petticoat government.
Right. Oh, you know, horror of horrors. We've got a woman for president. Well, you know, if you're going to have a surrogate president, that's a big if. And in this case, I think we should not have. But if you're going to have a surrogate president, then I think the question would be, all right, how well does the person who is the surrogate play that role? And Frank, I don't want to brag too much here, but I don't think anybody before me ever really asked that. How good a job did she do? Well, frankly, the best job I think anybody could have done, because she knew Wilson's mind better than anybody else. So if you're going to have somebody being his surrogate at that critical juncture, nobody was better qualified to do it than Edith was.
Well, she called herself a steward,
of
Wilson. Right. And that she was a steward of who would see him and what she would see. And this really was because she was following doctor's advice.
Well, yes. Or the way
that's what she said.
That's the way she interpreted doctor's advice. Right. And I think Edith meant that. She did not try to usurp decisions. She did not try to put things there. And if she did, such as the Wilson, Wilson vetoed the Volstead Act. That was the prohibition enforcement law. Probably she and Tumulty together decided to do this. But they weren't doing something that Wilson himself wouldn't have done otherwise. In other words, she knew what he wanted, and therefore she did it. So, you know, I think what we've learned, she claims, she said, I never made a decision on my own. But then she said, I controlled who and what got to him. Well, I think we've learned a lot since then that he or she who controls access to the president to some degree is president.
Right, right. And that is in all the presidencies, they have somebody that they're very close to.
Right.
And that person, Rahm Emanuel or whomever,
the gatekeeper.
Yeah, there is a gatekeeper, and she was that.
Yeah.
But I think that actually running the I don't think she wanted to do that. I think
it
was way more. I think she was trying to tread water, just keep things in abeyance and hopefully the government would run. And she didn't know what was going to happen with her husband.
He was
not in good shape.
No. And the doctors weren't sure either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have come a long way in both understanding and treatment of strokes and of these kinds of things. One of the things that I got also from my neurologist friends was that the medical wisdom of the time was that you wanted to sequester somebody as much as you could and keep them from anything that would upset them or whatever. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what they do now, because they say that exacerbates the psychological impact of the stroke, the isolation.
Isolation in any health issue is one of the worst things that can happen.
That's right.
We need to stop for a break, and when we come back, we'll just kind of skirt over some of the big things that happened during the Wilson administration and talk about some of the major differences he made in what America is today. Our guest on All About Living is John Cooper. He is the author of the book, Woodrow Wilson, A Biography. And we'll be right back with Professor Cooper after these messages. You're listening to All About Living here on Madison 1670 WTDY.
This is All About Living with Carol Colby, Madison 1670. WTDY.
Welcome back. Our guest is Professor John Cooper, author of the book Woodrow Wilson, A Biography. For a podcast of this program, go to carolcobyradio.com. That's Carol Colby, K-O-B-Y, radio.com. We just have a few minutes left, and we haven't really even talked about the accomplishments of his administration. What are the major accomplishments?
The major accomplishments are an incredible amount of significant domestic legislation. Woodrow Wilson is one of the three great legislator presidents we've had, the other two being FDR and LBJ. Federal Reserve, income tax, Federal Trade Commission, first federal aid to farmers, a child labor law, unfortunately struck down by the Supreme Court, 8-hour law for railroad workers, first federal inheritance tax, Louis Brandeis to the Supreme Court, one of the great justices and the first Jewish person to be put on the court. All of this was done in his first administration. I mean, it's a spectacular record of legislative accomplishment, and he didn't have the extrinsic advantages that either FDR or LBJ had. He didn't have the depression, the emergency of the depression, and a blank check from the opposition. And in LBJ's case, of course, LBJ had spent his adult life on Capitol Hill and mastered the Senate. So, I mean, it's remarkable in that. Then you have foreign affairs. And, of course, he is the president during World War I. He had to deal with that. He was the one who took us into World War I. And that really begins
hesitantly.
Very, very hesitantly, very reluctantly. It was not something he wanted to do. But that's the thing that begins our permanent involvement as the world's greatest power. What he also tried to do, of course, was the League of Nations. He had this this plan for collective security that would keep the peace, would prevent another world war.
Had he not had his stroke, do you think he would have gotten the Senate to
Yes, 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 I do. That's one of those great ifs. But if he hadn't had the stroke, something better would have come out of that. There could have been, would have been, should have been, could have been some kind of compromise that, that would have put together. Granted, the obstacles to it were enormous. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the spiteful relations between President and Congress today, and a kind of, you know, in many ways, wanting the man to fail. I mean, I think Henry Cabot Lodge, in his own way, wanted Wilson to fail. And in spite of that, though, there was enough public pressure to want to do something, and a desire to try to do something. The question was how much, and particularly how much of a commitment should we make? I mean, that's what it all came down to, is how much should we make commitments and promises to keep the peace. Wilson wanted us to go pretty far in that. Some rejected it altogether. I mean, our own Bob La Follette was what they called an irreconcilable, somebody who wanted nothing to do with this, believed we ought to stay out of that, that it was a terrible imperialistic peace that we should have nothing to do with. But Lodge and others wanted to do something, but they also wanted to hedge the bets a lot. Of course, the question is, where's the half loaf?
And well, I think the leaders, they were looking at this as the war that ends all wars. Actually, and that phrase came from Lloyd George.
That's correct.
You know, many people attribute it to Woodrow Wilson.
Well, and that's unfortunate, because that and make the world safe for democracy, what he said was the world must be made safe for democracy. Yeah. And believe me, the difference between active and passive voice there is a world of difference.
It wasn't America that was going to define the guidelines rules. The world itself must work together.
Things like that, war to end all wars, make the world safe for democracy, those are the kind of catchphrases that are used to paint what I think is a caricature of Wilson, which is the unrealistic idealist who's trying to remake the world overnight. He just was not like that.
John Cooper, thank you so much. I invite you to come back. We have so much more to talk about. One thing else he did, from my perspective, women's suffrage.
That's right.
He was slow to come to the table, but he was very supportive of it.
I really think there's no other American male who played a greater role in getting that amendment through.
For a wonderful read, an understanding of American history, and it's almost like a support group to read about history and then put it in perspective and what happens today. John Cooper, author of Woodrow Wilson, a biography, thank you for being with us today. Thank you for listening to All About Living. Now go out and have a great rest of the weekend.